It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
Another baseball field is coming to Wacomoco County. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. It's called Field 7.5, and we locate it at the Henry S. Parker Athletic Complex in Salisbury. Field would provide a place for the Little League Challenger Division that allows those with physical and intellectual challenges to play the nation's pastime. It's just part of the Tri-County effort to serve nearly 3,000 youth in special education programs. In our studio this morning, take a look at the new project. Steve Miller, Director of Wacomoco County Recreation, Parks, and Tourism. Also, Darren Kovac, he is leader of the Challenger Program at the West Salisbury Little League, and Jeff Johnson, who represents the District 8 Little League. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So, Steve, let me turn to you, and first of all, tell me a little bit about how this project came about.
So it started probably about 9 months ago. Myself and Chris Bitters, who's the general manager of the Delmarva Shorebirds, we were sitting and talking. We work on a lot of projects together and brainstorming, and Chris actually floated the idea. We were talking about some different projects at the complex, and Chris said, "Hey, have you ever considered Challenger?" And at that point, I wasn't very familiar with the program, so kind of lit a fire when he suggested that. So started to do research and started to understand the population and the number of kids that are out there, and learned how little is being offered. And it just kind of snowballed from there. And the more we talked to people and we reached out and engaged folks, the more we felt like this was a project that really made sense for us as a county and also for the entire region.
So how do you envision this field? Where is it going to be? What kind of amenities are there going to be?
Sure. So as you mentioned, it'll be at the Henry Parker Complex. And the reason we call it Field 7.5 is because we're going to locate it between Field 7 and 8 at the complex. We just recently did a build out this past year to add four diamonds out there. So we've got eight total diamonds. Now this would be the ninth. But so it'd be at the complex, and the idea would be it's a mini ball field. We only have space for a smaller field, but I think it could accommodate this type of activity. And the goal would really be not only to build a field that would be both safe and functional for this activity, but also to add the amenities, like you said. So we want to provide access, obviously. We want to provide parking. We've heard in talking to parents and different folks that shade is very important to Challenger athletes. And then we even want to look at inclusive playground equipment where we could accommodate families while they're there if they're not playing or watching or have siblings, where there's some really neat new playground type equipment where kids with disabilities can interact with other kids on the same equipment. And there's a lot of new stuff out there where we think it'd be neat to incorporate that in as well. So families could really find a home out there and really feel included in the activity that happens.
So in terms of the organizations that you've been involved pulling in, obviously mm-hmm. you've been talking to the folks here, but to others, what kind of support have you gotten, especially from the county executive, Bob Culver?
Yeah, the executive's been 100% on board. He's been extremely supportive. His office has been completely behind the effort. We've talked certainly with the Little Leagues. That was a big part of this in trying to determine the interest. Jeff could tell you about it, but in District 8, there's 10 Little Leagues. And we went to a meeting, and all 10 Little Leagues were very supportive of the concept. we've talked to the Boards of Education, Special Education Programs, in Wicomico, Worcester, Somerset. They've been supportive. We've talked to Dove Point, Special Olympics. We've tried to reach out to as many groups as we can, and every group that we have talked to, it's been a green light. It's been a very positive response, which has encouraged us to keep pushing this forward.
And what kind of funding are we talking about in terms of doing the field?
So to initially build the field and the required amenities to get you access and those types of things, we anticipate it being about a $500,000 project. So we're seeking partial funding from the county in this budget that's happening right now for next year, state grant and then private donations. We think we can get to that $500,000 goal. If we can exceed that, which my goal is that we will be able to exceed that through private donations, we can look to add extra things. So there's things like field lights or additional playground equipment. There's other amenities that I think you could make it even better for folks. So I think at a minimum, we're looking at around $500,000, and that would be one of the drivers of the costs would be we would want the entire field to be synthetic turf. So there's a safety component to that where you could stitch the bases into the carpet. So if you have someone in a wheelchair or a walker, they're not having to navigate over an obstacle. But we also feel like it would be a safer alternative and really make it a special place to play instead of these kids being thrown to some backfield and kind of being an afterthought. We want to make something special for them so that this can be their home field. They come, they feel special, feel part of things. And so that's what we're looking at in terms of funding.
Darren, I'm going to turn to you. You're with the Challenger program of West Salisbury Little League. First of all, how did you become involved, or how did this come to your attention, and what was your involvement with this?
Actually, my daughter has Downs. She's 27 years old now. My wife went out 23 years ago and seen this started and picked up on a team out of Del Mar. Basically, this is a team that we've moved from Del Mar to West Salisbury about 19 years ago. I was a coach at West Salisbury and had the support of the presidents all since 19 years ago all the way through now with the Challengers program there.
So what does this mean to you in terms of seeing this expansion for folks who are challenged like that?
It's great because there's a lot of parents out here that doesn't realize that their child can actually play ball. You have regular kids that grow up that are able to play ball. Then this one family might have one child out of the bunch that cannot play ball, and they don't feel that it's safe for them to play. But if they ever come out to a game, you'll see the smiles and on the kids' faces and stuff. Put it this way, if they don't want to play no innings, if they just want to bat one time, we've had kids dig in the ground and dig for worms and stuff out in the outfield and stuff like that. So there's no...
They do that in regular Little League.
No limit to that.
Actually,
no limit to that. Just watching the kids small. I mean, we've had kids with feeding tubes and stuff in wheelchairs. You have a buddy system. A buddy comes up, swings the bat for them, and just to see that smile on that kid's face, that's nothing else better than that.
So what was there, you mentioned that you have a daughter that has Downs. So what was that experience like, having someone like that? And I assume she participated in baseball.
She's been participating for a long time. We usually go to Virginia Beach Mother's Day weekend. We've been doing that for several years. They have a big tournament down there. And just watching those kids, other kids from other teams, and you meet other parents with different issues that you've probably already gone through, but they haven't gone through yet. You can help them get through that part of the issue on where they need to go with their child or whatnot and continue playing ball.
Mm-hmm. Was it hard? Was it in terms of raising your kid and your child and trying to adapt to a world which tends not to be very friendly, I guess?
It's you just gotta have the support. You gotta have the support around, and some parents don't have that complete support. So when they come to you as a parent with a ball player, then it opens up. It opens their eyes a little bit more. Hey, my child can play. I can relieve a little bit of pressure off myself to have this child out here playing something, not being home the whole time.
So and the kids, they seem to not just simply get along, but there's a certain camaraderie, I think, yes, that takes place at these kinds of games, these kinds of events?
Yes. These games, what we do, the Challengers division, we play two innings. Everybody bats. The last hitter cleans the bases. He's the cleanup hitter. And then you go into the field, toss the ball. The other team comes up. They'll hit the ball. And there's some other ball players that don't get that ball. So you have a couple extra balls in the field. You toss in the ball. So they're actually being active in the field of play. Then the next inning comes up. you reverse your lineup. The last batter, he's the first hitter. You switch that around. You don't make the last batter always your cleanup hitter. Hmm. You just change the lineup around.
By the way, now, have you been involved with, I guess, in Little League for a while then? I mean, beyond this, right?
Oh,
I mean,
yes.
Did you play baseball when you were younger, I guess?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, what's your history with that?
I've played baseball my whole life.
That's right.
I played softball and everything like that. I was a coach at West Salisbury for years. And when we moved the Challenger team there, I was doing baseball through Little League and Junior League, and my wife was doing the Challengers at the same time. So we were double teaming that.
So I suspect that eventually, and when you get to your 60s and 70s, we're going to see you out there, the seniors. Is that right? I talked to a bunch of those guys. And one of them said, well, you know, Father Time is undefeated, but, you know, they get out there anyway.
I can still teach, but I'm not going to play. I'm done playing.
Jeff Johnson, you represent the District 8 Little League. Tell me about how you got involved and how you envision this.
Well, with West Salisbury, I believe my first introduction to it was when we took one of the local teams was in Bristol, Connecticut, advancing, and there was a Challenger game that was played up there, and it was very very heartwarming to watch the kids, get out there, you know, with whether it be walkers or wheelchairs or whatever it was, and they've seen baseball on TV, and so they would get out there and they knew what was supposed to do and it'd be done. And when I came back to with West Salisbury, it was sometime in about I guess 15 years ago, met Darren and Tina, who were running the Challenger program, and it was somewhere by that time they had been at Del Mar I think we talked about maybe we're coming over to West Salisbury and see what we can do, and that's kind of how we got started, and really it's when it comes down to it, it's just kids wanting to play baseball, what we found also is they would be part of, you know, Challenger team is just like any other team we would have out there, participate opening day and all the other events. And one thing Darren mentioned earlier about the buddy system, we had kids on other teams that would come out and help participate in the Challenger game. And as you said, basically buddy up with another player. And basically just be a one-on-one teammate if they needed help running or hitting or just standing and walking beside them, you know, that's what they did. And I know my son was involved, really took that up. Mm-hmm. And even to this day, you probably don't even know this, Darren, but one of the friendships he established with one of the players, you know, they're even though it's 10 plus 12 years now, and they still talk and they attend birthday parties together, and so it's been a lasting friendship.
Do you think, by the way, that experience opens that world up and that diversity for regular kids?
Well, I think yes, because I think at that age, and I'll tell you frankly, even for some adults,
it does.
Don't necessarily how, you know, it's they see a kid that's, you know, it's different, but it's all kids. And so I think that was an introduction, you know, it's to, I don't know if you want to say break the ice, but it just provided that opportunity to get to know that that's something that they're not familiar with, that and to be a part of.
You could say hey, Darren, you agree that there's an interaction?
Yes, it is. It's an eye opener because, you know, when we all grow up, put it this way, and I'll be honest with you, there's probably 90% of people in the world that didn't want to associate with people like that, the kids. Until you have one yourself, that's a bigger eye opener than anything. than when that sibling has, when your regular child has a sibling in there, you can see that it's more of a connection in the family, family-wise. Then when it starts spreading out, those kids are protected even more. My daughter, she has Downs. She went to Wye High. She played Wye High basketball at Wye High for 3 years. JV level and varsity level.
Hmm.
And those girls protected her no matter what.
I bet that's a real sort of intimate camaraderie, I guess. That's...
Yes.
And for you, did you, Jeff, did you learn that connection before you got involved with this? Or were you one of those people who, I mean, there are lots of us, you know, we go about our daily lives, never seen anything, right?
And then I grew up with friends someone had Downs.
Oh, okay.
And it was always just kids to me. But I certainly knew, other folks that just didn't, you know, had the exposure. And sometimes in the school system, you know, the kids with the disabilities, you know, they sit at a different table and they do their own thing. And there's not a lot of interaction. I'll just bring up my son again. And some of his friends, once they got to Salisbury Middle School after doing this, every single day, they would sit at the table with the other kids that would like be part of the Challenger program, and they did it all through high school, and I think it's just I know I keep saying this, but they're just kids and they're just friends, and I think that's how they look at it.
And I can both of you. There's a certain emotional. I mean, you're big guys. Let's just say for the radio audience, you're big guys there. But there seems to be sort of a certain emotional component to this and all, Darren.
It is. You just watch how regular kids grow up, and these kids are struggling with their life, and especially the parents that have to keep taking them back and forth to doctor appointments, doctor visits, hospital stays, weeks at a time, and sometimes months at a time. It puts a strain on your whole family. It really does. And that's why the Challenger program is a good asset to other parents, is due to because they can get that relief from somebody else that's probably been there and struggled through the same component with the Challengers and all the way through life. Mm-hmm. Schoolwork, how school systems are set up, their behaviors in the schools, your 504s and your ADHD mm-hmm. kids and all that, autisms.
Hmm. And what about you, Jeff? There seems to be a certain emotional component to all this for you, too.
I think you just become attached.
Yeah.
And you just... You just love the kids, and sometimes maybe they hold a special place with them. And you know, when we did the games at West Salisbury, the kids who, you know, I remember one kid who he was in a wheelchair and he couldn't walk, but I remember he wanted to be the catcher, and he insisted on getting out of his wheelchair and sitting behind home plate, and I believe I was. Umpiring the games,
right?
And it's just a bond that you spill, that you get to enjoy, share with the kids. And
Steve, this is really sort of part of. As I mentioned a moment ago, that there are lots of programs, I guess, for those who are challenged in this fashion. I mean, I take it this is sort of just one more piece of that.
It is, and I think as a county, that's been one of the exciting things about this. it's just the ability to reach out to a segment of the population and really provide an opportunity. And really, that's what this is about. As the guys mentioned, this is about kids playing baseball and having opportunities. And many times, these kids are either forgotten or don't know that opportunities are out there. And I'm excited that you know, by building this, I think we're really going to have an opportunity to reach people in the county and even beyond that, where we can invite them in and give them that opportunity to participate like everybody else. And it's been one of the, honestly, in a, you know, you mentioned the emotional connection and all, you know, I'm getting more and more exposed as we go down this road. But one of the joys of this for me on a personal level is connecting with guys like Jeff and Darren and several other families that we've gotten to know and talk to as we've gone through this process. And it's just been kind of neat to, you know, intersect lives with them where ordinarily maybe you wouldn't. You just travel in different circles. And so, you know, us going down this road has really gotten already, we haven't even built anything yet, we've been able to connect with people in the community that maybe we wouldn't have connected with. And that's been fun. And I'm hoping as this continues down the track, there's a lot of other families out there that we want to connect with, and we really want to open our arms and make this a possibility for their kids to participate. So
I ran across one, I can't remember who it was by, said talking about that not having this, they were sort of missing an opportunity to serve this particular segment of the population. Why do you think, I mean, obviously you're sort of serving this population with all kinds of other programs. Why do you think we haven't done this before? Just didn't come to notice?
I don't know, honestly. I can't speak to all that, but you know, I can only speak from the county level. We right. have a camp that we run for special needs at Camp Pinehurst in the summertime. But beyond that, you know, we haven't done a lot, and I think there's more that can be done. And as to why it hasn't been done, I don't know the answer to that. But I think, you know, it's better late than never. One story I'll share with you. Darren's wife, Tina, obviously has been very involved with Challengers over the years. And I remember calling Tina, and I've told this story before, but I called Tina 8 or 9 months ago when we started down this path, and we had a really great conversation, and she was pretty excited about what I was trying to tell her, the direction we wanted to go. And I remember Tina kind of ending the conversation. I could hear on the end of the phone just a little bit of emotion with her, and she kind of told me at the end, she said, I've been waiting 20 years to get this phone call. And that was kind of neat, just to know that she's been out there, and Darren and people like Jeff been plugging away for a long time, and it's better late than never with this kind of thing. And I'm thrilled that we can play a part in this, and we're just really excited about it.
So when do you think you might have this this project accomplished, that the field in place and the kids on the field?
So our goal is next April. We want to open up next spring. We've asked for some funding in the FY20 county budget, which will be adopted in the next month. So if the funding all falls into place as we hope, we would begin constructing it in the fall, and we'd want to open it up next spring. So because of the size of it, it's not a real big field. We can get that done in a relatively short period of time. So our goal is next spring.
By the way, how much smaller is a field? Do you have any idea what the, yes, as opposed to a regular one?
Yeah, so a typical Little League field would usually be in around a 200-foot fence, and this would be about 115. So okay. it will be a shrunk field, and these guys can speak more to it. But Challenger, in a lot of cases, is an infield game. And we can raise the fence to make it play a little longer if we needed to, but we are restricted in some ways with the physical space that we have, that we can't go much bigger than 115. But we went out to, there's a Miracle League field out in Montgomery County, which is a similar type field for the same type of activity. We went there, and actually they measured the same thing, about 115 down the line. So that's about what we envision.
So Jeff or Darren, so what kind of difference? I mean, obviously we're talking about size in terms of the size of the field. I assume that's fairly standard. Anything else that differs from the regular fields? Or,
well, I think one thing that the county will be able to offer when we've over at West Salisbury, it's one of the things you have to move around the field itself. It's a dirt infield,
right?
And also there's a chain link fence around it. And sometimes, I know Darren and I, we've always tried to figure out, well, sometimes wheelchairs and other items don't fit through the opening. And so I believe that has restricted some kids' participation in the past. And even though when you work on a baseball field, you still don't get it smooth. And so by having the surface that Steve is talking about, might open a door for a few more. I think the other thing also is getting the county involved. the folks who are just not in Salisbury, but maybe other places, they see that does, and maybe, okay, well, that's something I really want to be a part of. And I think that's part of Steve and Darren's, you know, the big picture is really just to bring it in from not just Wicomico and maybe Worcester and Somerset and Sussex, but, you know, other areas. And who knows where this thing can go. And, you know, there's that Darren had mentioned earlier, they are going to Virginia Beach for a regional tournament. And I know years ago, Darren and I talked about trying to host one here in Salisbury. And, well, having a field at the complex, now you got hotels and restaurants and all that stuff that families can travel in, and so it just opens that door.
Yeah, by the way, are there other places on Delmarva that have this sort of thing? Do you know?
The only one I'm aware of in Wicomico, Worcester, Somerset is what Darren's doing at West Salisbury. Yeah.
But beyond that, like the other county, Caroline.
Easton's got one. Yeah. Easton's got three or four teams up there. They've got a youth team now, maybe two, I think it is, and two senior teams. Mm-hmm. And she's been doing it for a long time up there. We've played them a couple times before. The last time I knew that Preston had one, but I don't know if Preston has one anymore or not. Somerset, we used to play Somerset about 4 years ago, mm-hmm. and they've... the coach stopped doing that, and we ended up getting some of her ball players to play at West for a couple years.
Well, we've been speaking with Steve Miller. He's a director of Wicomico County Recreation Parks and Tourism. Also, Darren Kovacs. He is a leader of the Childcare Program at the West Salisbury Little League, and also Jeff Johnson, a representative for the District 8 Little League. And we appreciate you stopping by. Good luck to you guys. And if you get it all together, we'll come down and at least cover a little bit, and maybe talk to some of the kids. That'd be really great.
That's fantastic.
Chris, thank
great.
You.
Thank you.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. Another four more acts are coming to the National Folk Festival. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Preparations for the National Folk Festival are picking up speed, and so is a lineup of artists. This morning, we'll be taking a look at one of America's guitar legends, as well as a piano player who specializes in Appalachian music. And then we'll take a look at a dynamic Brazilian tradition and close out with something from Louisiana. Our guests this morning are Caroline O'Hare, the local manager for the festival, and Blaine Wade. He's programming manager for the National Council for the Traditional Arts. And welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
Good morning, Don. Good
morning. So let me turn to you, Caroline. What is the latest now? I think the last time we talked, we were talking about lots of volunteers and so on. What's going on?
Volunteers are filling in shifts and doing an amazing job. Our festival desk, I have to have a shout out to Dr. Melissa Boog. Her team is almost completely full. I think there's one, maybe two more shifts available, so way to go to Festival Desk. And everyone else is signing up in different areas. We're doing this early this year, which is great. Next month, we're going to announce who has been selected to participate in the festival marketplace, as well as who our food vendors are going to be. And then, super fun, amazing news. I'm very excited about this.
A little drum roll, okay.
Yeah, a little bit of a drum roll, because actually this is the first time I've said this in public to media, if you will, we have a new sponsor that is joining us, and that is the Baltimore Orioles. They are going to be a stage sponsor, and we are very excited to partner with them. In fact, we are going to have an amazing event coming up at the Oriole Park on June 26. It will be a full day of exclusive activities and just amazing fun. And we'll have more details to come soon. But that's all in support of the National Folk Festival. It's a fundraiser to help us, you know, get this festival going again and being more spectacular than ever.
So let's turn to some of the acts that we're talking about. Lane, I guess one is Bill Kirshen, and he apparently, as I understand, is made a bit of a local guy.
Bill was a longtime resident of Calvert County. Over there near the bay in the southern part of Maryland. Bill has since moved on to Austin, but he spent a number of years living there in Calvert County and with his group, it was Bill Kirchen and Too Much Fun. They were just a really great band, a real rave-up darlings of the Washington, D.C. music scene, and also playing over into Maryland. He also received grant support from the Maryland State Arts Council for a number of things, but really thrilled to be bringing Bill back home, so to speak, and he will be playing at the festival with his longtime collaborators here in the state of Maryland who played with him when he had that great D.C. band going, our band playing always in D.C. We've got bassist Johnny Castle and on drums Jack O'Dell.
And this is the kind of music, some of the descriptions I've heard are some of this Western swing, rockabilly, bluegrass, truck driving music. Tell me a little bit about the kind of music we're listening to.
Of course. Well, Bill is really at heart, he's known as the Titan of the Telecaster, and we consider him a master of Telecaster guitar traditions. He's just has an encyclopedic knowledge of American electric guitar traditions, all of which kind of fall under the broad umbrella term country. And what he plays really reflects the deep diversity of country music, and he's a real just Trevor trove of knowledge about this, and drawing on a lot of the traditions you referenced, Western swing, rockabilly, bluegrass. But over the years, he's really become known for truck driving music, or a genre he's sort of been labeled as being the preeminent practitioner of, called Dieselbilly, which kind of captures everything he's drawing on and the stories he's telling of guys in semi-trucks out on the road and their adventures with these great guitar licks really driving the music.
And of course, he's famous for the Hot Rod Lincoln. Tell me a little bit about that. If someone has never heard of it, which I can't believe, tell me a little bit about that.
Sure. So coming up, when Bill really first put his name on the map in the 1970s, he was a member of the group Commander Cody and his Lost Planet Airmen, and played with them from the late 60s through the mid-70s. And it was his guitar playing that everybody can associate with Hot Rod Lincoln, which was a big hit for them. And what Bill has turned this into is just a high-energy romp through so many of these guitar traditions I was talking about, and it becomes a real way for him to acknowledge the many people who influenced his playing, from Merle Travis to James Burton to Buck Owens, really seminal figures in country guitar history. And so Bill starts the song off, and he's telling a story about being on the road with his Hot Rod Lincoln, but a couple of minutes in, he just uses it to veer into riffing on all of these signature, basically guitar riffs of these great figures, a little bit of Johnny Cash, a little bit of Buck Owens, a little bit of James Burton. Then he'll do a shout-out to everybody from Iggy Pop to B.B. King, and he's got, you know, even throws in a nice little ping in reference to Billie Jean King, so it's also becomes a great vehicle for Bill's wonderful sense of humor, and it's just 10 minutes of absolute fun that I'm sure people are going to get to experience at the festival.
I saw a quote. It says that I've always considered myself a folk musician. Thought I tend to be one that plays too loud and too fast. I think that's true.
Oh, well, I think it depends on how you think about folk music and true, and as we like to say, traditional music. But for us, I mean, Bill fits squarely in that because he's carrying on so many of these important guitar traditions, the electric guitar that people think of when they think of really mid-20th century and moving forward American music. But, you know, I like that. That's a quote we like to call out, too, and I love that he says it because it sort of challenges what people think of when they think of traditional music, and it's so much of what we're about with the National. This is not only about acoustic music or you know, singer-songwriter music. This is about the wide breadth of traditions that have really helped to define American cultural identity throughout our history. And electric guitar traditions are central to that. And Bill is just a walking museum of that knowledge. And he brings it all to the stage and shares that knowledge. And we love how he plays loud and fast.
Well, let's hear a little bit of him.
Well, he put six strings on a maple stick, stuck it on a slab of ash, sold one to Luther, threw in a pit, set him out with Johnny Cash. I put Leo Fender and the gang of Gnome at the factory in Fullerton, that the honk and twang of the Telecaster tone would outlast him everyone.
and all up in your face. Chip thunder and lightning rod. Well, it was more at the junction of form and function. It's the hammer of a honky-tonk god. It's the hammer of the honky-tonk god.
And Caroline, I guess he's going to be really up front at the festival.
He is. We're having this awesome kickoff for sponsors and donors next week at Salisbury University, and Bill and friends are going to be joining us for a really fun, quick performance to showcase the talent that's coming to Salisbury in September.
I want to turn to something that's a little unusual, the Jeff Little Trio. And what I say unusual is that he plays the piano, but is also part of the Appalachian music tradition, which is not necessarily known as the lead for a piano. Tell us a little bit about that, Blaine.
Oh, definitely. So you're right on there, Don, that when most people think of Appalachian music and Appalachian traditions, they're thinking of, you know, banjo and fiddle and guitar and the early roots of bluegrass music and maybe also some storytelling, and the ballad singing tradition is very deep in the Blue Ridge Mountains. But that's not what Jeff is doing. Jeff is not something you think of when you think of this music, but he really represents this great tradition, and he stands out as the best practitioner of it, of this playing piano and this piano playing tradition in the Blue Ridge Mountains. And what's so interesting with Jeff is, in doing it, he's actually heavily influenced by these other string traditions that you would associate more quickly with that region, especially flat pick guitar. And he's taken that and sort of filters it in through and puts it back out on piano with this wonderful, distinctive two-handed style he has in playing, with great speed and precision and clarity. So he's taking that regional heritage, but merging that with his own interests and talents, and has put out something that is absolutely fascinating. And Jeff is just a charming stage performer, and is sure to be a crowd favorite. You don't know what to expect when he takes the stage, but the next 45 minutes to an hour are just going to be absolutely pleasurable.
Now, I guess he comes from North Carolina, and his family had a music store.
Yeah, it's a really interesting story. He's from a small town of Boone, sort of nestled there in the corner of North Carolina, a beautiful area of the country not far from where the Merlefest festival takes place. And his family had the local music store, like you said, simply known as Little's Music Store. And the great Doc Watson was a regular. You know, Doc is a huge figure in American music history, known as for early old-time country and as a great flat picker and influencing the development of bluegrass, and had just had a huge amount of influence on guitarists who came after him. And he was just a family friend who was always in the shop and had a large amount of influence on Jeff as he was going through his formative years and taking an interest in music. And then once Jeff became a professional musician, they performed together with great frequency in Doc's later years. So it was a very special relationship for Jeff, had a lot of influence on him, and is something that was just part of his everyday life and everyday experience from a young age in his parents' music store.
And I guess it says that he's really conversant in lots of genres. I mean, from traditional jazz to country, obviously country bluegrass and so on. So he does have this flair for not just simply one genre.
Oh, no, most definitely. When any Jeff Little set is going to be a rich experience for the audience and the listeners, because he's touching on so much, very conversant, like you said. I mean, he starts and he's got that deep roots in the old time and the Appalachian tradition, but very, very skilled at playing traditional jazz. He can do a touch of Dixieland, get a little funky in that, and with the instrumentalists with him trading off solos, of course, veers into country and bluegrass, but there's also, you know, from when he was growing up, the ability to play some great rockabilly tunes, and he even has a rack-mounted harmonica and adds that in. So it's a really rich and textured performance where Jeff is drawing on a lot of traditions that influenced him and are key to American music.
And now alongside him is going to be, Steve Lewis and his son there, Luke Little. Tell us a little bit about those two, what they're going to be doing.
Sure. As amazing as Jeff is, the trio itself is just a great combination of talent. It's the sum of the parts is amazing, and each individual player, though, is really talented. Steve Lewis is a longtime collaborator of his. He's one of the most respected guitar and banjo players in that part of the Blue Ridge Mountains where North Carolina and Virginia intersect. He's taken top honors at a number of contests throughout the country for his playing on banjo and guitar at the national championships at Walnut Valley in Kansas, and in many of the festivals and the contests that take place closer to home in North Carolina and Virginia. Of course, there's Merle Fest, the Old Fiddlers Convention in Galax. So he's hugely respected in the community, and Steve also is teaching many of the younger next-generation players who are up and coming, so passing on his knowledge. And speaking of younger players, there's Jeff's son, Luke, who has recently joined the trio and plays mandolin. And he, of course, you know, growing up with his father being Jeff, was introduced to music very early on and had great influence and a great environment for learning. And he's really stepping out on his own and quickly earning recognition himself, already starting to place in contests in the region. And so when you put those three together, what's so amazing is the interplay between them, these really rich textures as they're trading leads, and to see Jeff and Steve and how they go back and forth, and the young energy that Luke's now bringing in and the family connection. It's a really exciting trio that's really going to surprise people, and it's going to be a lot of fun.
Let's take a little bit of that. Of course, that was the Jeff Little Trio, and we were going to be checking it out, seeing how it sounds out there in the downtown Salisbury. We now have something from Brazil, of African origin, actually. Tell us a little bit about that.
Gladly. So this is, the tradition is capoeira. Capoeira is a really exciting combination that's drawing on dance, martial arts, acrobatics, as the traditions evolved into the 20th century, bringing in elements of breakdancing as well. But the roots of this go back to, as so much in the world, unfortunately, to the history of slavery and enslaved Africans bringing traditions to Brazil in the 16th century. It goes way back almost half a millennium. And many of these enslaved Africans were coming from Congo and Angola, and brought traditions with them that evolved into capoeira. It's part dance and part game, and it, through a process of creolization, combining with other traditions there and the different cultures coming together in Brazil, really thrived on the plantations and in enslaved communities, as well as the communities that escaped slaves would found, but it very much became a way of resisting slavery. At the same time, though, the Portuguese slaveholders, when looking and seeing all of this going on the plantations, were and seeing martial arts practiced and this sort of insinuation of violence, made them quite nervous. And so this was banned for a long time in Brazil until the late 1800s. And even when the ban was lifted, it was a marginalized working class street game until the really just after World War One, in between World War One and World War Two. And then in the 1930s, it started to get acceptance in Brazil and became the national sport of Brazil and is now celebrated worldwide. Even being included on the list of intangible cultural heritage that is maintained and updated by UNESCO. But it's a really dynamic and exciting tradition that should be new to a lot of people. It's a celebration of movement, drawing on all these different movement traditions in the context of a game interaction between the participants.
Tell a little bit about the lead performer here, because I understand he really sort of began this thing about the age of 10.
Yeah, so the group coming is named Capoeira Luanda. The group was founded by Mestre Jalon Vieira. Mestre is the term for master in the tradition, and Mestre Jalon is one of the most significant, if not the most significant, capoeira master in the United States. He comes from Bahia, the region of Brazil where the tradition really first emerged and grew and evolved. And like you said, he started playing, as they say, you play capoeira. He started playing at the age of 10, and it's a great story. He was on his way to get a haircut, and on his way, he came upon some people playing capoeira, and he was just fixated. And he watched for 4 to 5 hours and went home, and only when he got home did he realize he didn't even get a haircut. But he was, at that point, convinced he had to go out and learn, but in this period, the capoeira was still heavily stigmatized in Brazil, and his mother didn't want him practicing. So he found a way on the sly to go learn from some of the great masters in Brazil, some of the most important figures in the development of the tradition. And then when he would come home, his pants ripped, his legs dirty, just from the physical activity, he would lie and tell his mother he was out playing soccer. And so that's how he was able to sort of start learning the tradition and climb up through the levels of accomplishment. He came to the United States in the mid-70s, and really you can trace so much of the interest in the States and then internationally in capoeira to the efforts of Mestre Jalon. He's really advocated for, perpetuated, supported, and really helped catalyze interest in it. He founded Capoeira Luanda about 12 years ago, and since then it has chapters or branches across the country as well as in 10 countries, and that really speaks to his influence. And then in 2008, not long after that, he was recognized with a National Heritage Fellowship, which is the highest honor the federal government can give to a folk and traditional artist. This is from the National Endowment for the Arts. So that really spoke to his significance within the tradition and the community in the United States. And so to have him come and bring 10 of his best capoeira performers and musicians, they play different instruments to support the game that takes place in a circle, is going to be a real special experience to bring to Salisbury for this year's festival.
So give us an idea of what this is going to look like. And in fact, I guess there are actually a number of different instruments involved, as well as a sort of a call and response.
Oh, of course. So capoeira, as like I said, you say capoeira is played. So it'll be on stages most often, though we might look for an alternative way of presenting it. But it works very well on a stage. But it takes place within the community in what's called a hoda, which is just a term for a circle. So people gather in the round. And inside the circle, there's a large number of people that make up the circle. It could be 12, it could be 20. For the sake of the festival, there's going to be 10 people. And within the circle, two capoeiristas take turns squaring off in this stage battle, this part game, part dance. And to support them while they're going through the different movements, what happens in capoeira is, say there's a punch or a kick, it comes just close enough to touch but not to touch. So it's all this very graceful movement that stages fighting without anything actually happening. So it's these really beautiful movements when you watch it. But while the competitors are playing the game inside the circle, around it you have people playing what's called a birimbau, which is a gourd-resonated musical bow. It's kind of a large fiddle held, or looks almost like a kora from the West African tradition. But it's a gourd with a long bow. And then you also have a couple of different percussion instruments that are playing while the competition is taking place. The pandeiro, which kind of is like a tambourine-sized frame drum, and what's called a atabaque, which is a hand drum that looks kind of like a conga. So you have these instruments playing, but the other element to this is there's a chorus of singers singing call and response songs, and these are sort of improvisatory, but they draw from capoeira history, stories of legendary mestres, and then playful anecdotes about what's going on. So you have this great movement going on, and this call and response singing, all with a layer under that of string instruments and percussion. So it's really a feast for the senses.
Well, now finally turn to our final, which is Zydeco. A great tradition here, certainly in the United States, out of Louisiana. Tell us a little bit about, particularly about the group, the Terry and the Zydeco Bad Boys.
Oh, we're really excited. excited. This is an artist who will be making his National Folk Festival debut this year in Salisbury, and his name is Terry Deming, and he fronts a group called Terry and the Zydeco Bad Boys. And he's really a rising star, an up-and-coming figure in Zydeco. He's been playing down. Terry's from Dusson, which is about 10 miles west of Lafayette. And if you're familiar with Louisiana at all, Lafayette's really sort of the cultural capital or the centerpiece of French Louisiana, French-speaking Louisiana, being Cajun or Creole culture. And so Terry grew up just outside of Lafayette, and has been earning a name for himself really for about just over 15 years with his band, but hasn't played a lot nationally. So really excited to get him out and bring him to Salisbury for the National Folk Festival. And Zydeco, of course, is one of the music traditions people associate with French culture in Louisiana. Last year we had a Cajun group, Steve Riley and the Mamou Playboys, and this year we're really thrilled to be bringing a Zydeco group. And Zydeco is a form that emerged out of some earlier forms, most specifically La La music, which was French Creole music, largely acoustic, and then shortly after World War II, what was a really musically fertile period. You know, blues is electrifying in Chicago, R&B is starting to develop, and so these things are influencing Black French Creole culture in Louisiana, and so they're adding into La La music the accordion and R&B influences and bass and drums, and what you have is this really danceable and highly energetic music that became hugely popular in African-American communities in Louisiana, and that's what, you know, Terry is just part of that next generation, really carrying that tradition forward and doing it in a very traditional but innovative way.
Now, I understand that he actually became enthralled with the accordion at, the age of four?
Yeah, so his dad would take him to what are called trail rides. Another big part of French Creole culture in Louisiana is cowboy culture. You have cattle ranching is very big, and big cattle ranches and cowboys work in these ranches. And trail rides are where that culture and the Zydeco culture intersect. A lot of Zydeco bands play regularly at what we might call a festival, but it's a trail ride is what the term there at many of these. And so Terry, growing up around this, would go to trail rides with his dad at a very young age, and recalls at the age of four when he first remembers just being enthralled by the Zydeco bands, and particularly the accordion players. And that's when he said, that's what I want to do. So by the age of eight, he had, you know, taught himself how to play, got his first accordion, and never really looked back. But the other really important part of Terry's upbringing and how his family really immersed him in these traditions and helped put him on this path were his grandparents. They insisted that he learn to speak French Creole as he was growing up. That was part of their heritage, and it was very important to them that that's something Terry learned. So as he came out and started playing Zydeco, the other something that's really important when you're playing traditional Zydeco is singing many of the songs in French Creole, and that's something that's a big part of Terry's repertoire. So he's got really deep roots, and many go back to just the family environment he grew up in.
And now he draws, I understand, obviously from Cajun music, but as well as something called swamp pop. What is swamp pop?
Yeah, swamp pop is a tradition of sort of Louisiana rock and roll and pop, sort of touching on how popular influences were influencing it. So taking the particular traditions of Louisiana, Cajun culture, Zydeco music, and giving that a little more of a rock and roll or a pop bent. But the songwriting and the themes still reflected life in Louisiana, but in a way that also probably were, you know, touching on some of the themes of, you know, independence and love lost, and that were more identifiable or more reflective of that early rock and roll culture. So there's probably a touch of rockabilly and that early rock and roll sound, but coming into contact and coming through the filter of those local Cajun and Zydeco traditions. But it just speaks to, you know, Terry very much conscious of tradition. He's singing traditional songs in French, and singing classics by legends like Buzu Chavis and John Delafosse, but also as he's writing his new material or arranging this traditional material, he's pulling in these other influences to keep the music energetic and up to date. So the swamp pop, R&B, a touch of that, but only doing it in such a way as it keeps the tradition fresh, not taking it a little too far where it becomes maybe a little unidentifiable. So he's really walking that great line that that line that traditional artists do so well between tradition and innovation, and carrying the tradition on for future generations.
Finally, I saw a quote. He says that music to me is my therapy. When I get on stage, I forget all about my troubles and free my soul. Think that's when you heard his music? You think that that's what's happening there on that stage?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when you watch Terry play, there's just a lot of joy and energy to what he does. And, you know, like I said earlier, this is energetic, danceable music. So it's, you know, when people go out in Louisiana to hear Zydeco Band, they're going to what's called down there dance halls. Maybe in Mississippi, this would have been called a juke joint. That's where, you know, we would go to see blues. In Louisiana, they're dance halls. And so when folks are going out to see this music, it's about having a good time. It's a Friday night. It's a Saturday night. You're putting the troubles and the stresses of the week behind you. And it's the same for the musician as it is the dancers. And actually, that makes me want to note one thing we'll try to do, of course, for one of Terry's performances is have a Zydeco dance lesson. We did a Cajun dance lesson last year for one of Steve Riley's performances, and very much something we will plan to do this year is on one of Terry's performances, precede it with a 30-minute dance lesson so people can learn how the two steps and the waltzes and the traditional dance steps for a Zydeco performance, and will just enhance the fun. And our hope is that this what folks experience down in Louisiana when they go see a Zydeco band of having a good time and kind of putting the troubles of the world out of their minds for a little bit is what we're able to bring to audiences in Salisbury. Because when Terry hits the stage, he's going to get people up and moving, and they're going to have a really great time.
And I know Caroline's going to get out there and do that, right?
Absolutely. I am. If you want some comic relief, come watch me at the dance lesson. You know what I'm noticing is there's a lot of energy and a lot of speed with the four artists that we're announcing today. And everyone can check them out at nationalfolkfestival.com. We've got bios and audio clips and video clips. But yes, for fun, if you'd like, please come to the dance stage and watch me fling my arms about.
Well, let's hear a little of what you'd be flinging your arms to.
Dans la baillère, tu fais un gros mignon. Au ballon, avec madame, si madame canaille comme moi. Et tu fais un gros mignon, ça quitte ta pécanaille. Et ça quitte ta pécanaille, au ballon dans la baillère.
Well, that wraps up at least this. We certainly look forward to Caroline doing her dance. We'll get you all down there. We're speaking with Caroline O'Hare. She's the local manager of the festival, the National Folk Festival here in Salisbury. Also, Blaine Wade. He is a programming manager for the National Council for the Traditional Arts. Appreciate you both chatting with us this morning.
Thank you.
Thanks, Don. And real quick, again, the dates for this year's festival are September 6th through 8th. So we're looking forward to seeing everyone in downtown Salisbury that weekend after Labor Day.
And there you go. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Don.